Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today's program starts off with somebody we always look forward to interviewing. He's brilliant, Jim Leahy. He is brilliant. I mean, he has ideas in this book that I have to read three times to grasp.
Well, I think it's fair to say that he's revolutionized the way people baking. think about making bread.
Yes.
There's no question about it.
His bakery is called the Sullivan Street Bakery, and that's the name of his book that we're going to be talking to him about.
The interesting thing is, he's not just a one-trick pony, because in this book he reveals the recipes for all kinds of things.
They also
sell at Sullivan Street Bakery.
Yeah.
That sound equally as delicious as the bread, and certainly what I would line up for.
Yes.
And then we've got more surprises coming down the road. So let's get this show going.
On the road. Yeah. Now, Jim Leahy, we have you on the phone. Is Maya with us, too?
Well, Maya's in the background.
I see. Maya, hello. Jim, hello.
Hi, Maya.
This is a brilliant
book. Waving hi, politely.
It's called the Sullivan Street Bakery Cookbook, and that's obviously because you have a bakery called Sullivan Street Bakery.
Yes, I've had the Sullivan Street Bakery now since 1994.
Right.
It started on Sullivan Street in what was a very mostly Neapolitan and Sicilian neighborhood. Now it's just very trendy. I mean, remnants of the old neighborhood, but most of the people that I knew have moved on.
And this is in Manhattan, Jim, correct?
Yes, in what is Soho neighborhood.
Okay, very
right.
good.
And
so
we interviewed you, we've interviewed you before, I think a couple of times, but you really made a big splash with your no-knead bread. Is that...
Yeah.
Which I always meant to try. I haven't tried it yet.
No way.
Yeah.
What are you waiting for, Ann? You got to get out there and try it.
I know. I mean, everything looks so brilliant in this book that I'm just starving for the food in it, which means I've got to learn to make it since I'm not there.
Yeah.
I'm a little confused. I don't think I know enough about baking. I mean, I'm a cook but not a baker.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I know enough about fermentation to really get the gist of this. I read it and found I was not understanding it. And you tried to, you have diagrams, you have pictures of stages of fermentation. There's a lot to understand in this book, isn't there?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a simple principle, though. When you mix flour and liquid together, initially, it has a certain quality to it, and through fermentation, you end up creating other qualities to it,
right.
You know? In the essence, that's like the gist of it, but I mean, it's a matter of showing it kind of in a very accessible way, because we're not getting super scientific, but we're trying to deepen people's understanding of the role of fermentation, and also the cause and effect between how wet something is, its viscosity and cohesion, and what results from that.
But somewhere in there, Jim, are these little buggers called yeasts.
Yeah.
That like eating things that are in this mixture of flour and water.
Yeah,
I mean, we give them, there's always forces at work that we're not unaware of, that are always kind of persistent and perennial. And fermentation, upon dough, when you add flour and water together, you know, even if you don't add yeast, at some point fermentation will begin all on its own.
See, that's a concept I don't think I get for some reason. How do you know you get the good bugs and not the bad bugs?
Well, I mean, typically a reliable end result, a consistent end result, would be one way. Aroma and smell are a good indication of whether you have the good bugs or the bad bugs, notwithstanding, you know, an individual's personal opinion, because for one person, what may smell like spoilage to another person might be ideal. However, when we're looking at the function of yeasts and natural fermentation upon dough, we're looking at something that has a very specific set of effects, like the crumb gassing up and opening, like the flavor becoming kind of malty and then maybe even veering into kind of like slightly acidic or sweet, you know, as the fermentation goes progresses. There's a curve for every organism, every you know, there's only, when you make a batch of dough, it's just, you know, it's a finite quantity of flour, salt, liquid, and then you add some kind of leavening agent in the form of either powdered yeast, fresh yeast, or a sourdough. There's only a certain amount, you know, on that finite quantity of dough. There's a progression from, you know, the dough being put together and mixed initially to the point at which it's ready. And that point at which it's ready has a lot to do with our own individual expectations, needs, and desire. Like I always like to say with people when they ask me, well, isn't it hard to come up with a bread recipe? I'm like, no. You take some flour, some water, some liquid butter, whatever, eggs, and you mix it together, and you make this dough. And then in that you have some type of leavening agent, and over a period of time it begins to ferment. And at a certain point during the fermentation, you turn it into something. You put it into a mold, so it can leaven further and bake. You may shape it and put it into a mold or onto a board, and at which point you leaven it, you proof it, you ready it for the oven. Proofing is what we call it in baking language.
What, when it rises?
Yeah, the proof is right before you go to the printer, right before you go to the oven, right before you finalize your bread. You ready the proofing in the form to ready the bread prior to baking it.
Okay, let's do this. Wait a minute. Let's do this. I'm going to now make one of your bread recipes. I need to make bread. What do I do first?
Typically, I weigh out my dry ingredients first. And if it's a no-knead bread, I would add, whether it's sourdough or not, I would add all my dry ingredients in one container, and then in another bowl, I would weigh out or measure out my liquid ingredients, including the if it's natural leavening. If it's natural leavening, I would add the sourdough as part of the liquid ingredients.
But you have to get the sourdough first. You have to make that first.
You have to capture and then cultivate a starter. How do you do that? Well, I mean, they're in every bag of flour and in all flour you have the yeasts, the microbes, the flora prerequisite to make a sourdough starter. They exist during the life of the wheat berry on the very berry itself and on the wheat itself. In fact, you can find these sets of microbes on almost any, like, leafy plant
I wondered about that. You have kale that has, like, a
leaf type. We end up using, like you know, purple cabbage because it's so obvious.
Uh-huh.
On dark, especially on the outer leaves of cabbage, you can see this bloom. You know, you can also see it on grapes, except they're very delicate. And then the idea that I have in my book, the easier way of beginning a story, you can just add flour and water together, let it sit outside, and eventually it will ferment.
No,
you might not have a reproducible sourdough based on the first fermentation. It might require a successive, anywhere up to four successive refreshments of that initial starter to get a viable sourdough.
And that's your feeding, right?
Yeah, feedings, yeah. And what you're doing basically is you're knocking down, you're basically reincorporating the flour and water that went through this fermentation process, spontaneous fermentation process, and you're just saving, you're blending it together and then saving a small portion of it to seed the successive on the sourdough.
Now, Jim,
what happens is that if you hold the liquid under the right conditions, it will leaven. It will eventually kind of the types of yeast that, you know, the right flora of yeast and bacteria.
Now,
so it's really about whether or not you're doing it just with flour and water.
Yeah.
Which can work, and I've had, you know, innumerable successes doing it that way. Or whether you use, bloom that you lift from the outside of fruit or certain types of leaves or plants or the outer leaves of, like, cabbage. Then I find that to be more reliable. That's why we recommend it in the book.
Right.
Now, what is this thing called biga? B-I-G-A?
Well, biga is an Italian name for a pre-ferment.
Okay. All right.
No one really knows what the etymological origins of the word are. I've been looking for years. But it's what people call their starter, and I just refer to it as, like, I look at processes. Like, most of the times when you go to Italy, people make biga with yeast. Sourdough itself and natural fermentation has completely fallen out of favor in Italy.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, no one really uses natural fermentation.
But they do.
They call it natural. Bakers will call it natural fermentation, but it's not.
But this long process of the long ferment is very Italian, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Italians inherited lots of kind of bread knowledge from other cultures, and, you know, what we see when we go to a bakery in modern Italy are what remains of that old bread knowledge.
So I
like to look at what
I loved your story about the Florentine, the Tuscan bread. We had a moment with a waiter in Florence. And
yes.
I kept saying, why is the food so salty? And he said, it's because we don't put salt in our bread.
it makes this...
But you explained it.
There's a lot of sense to that, too, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It really is.
I think the guy was startled.
I ended up having somebody make me some salumi recently, and the salumi that they made me was so salty that I now have to take some of the salumi that this guy made me and see whether or not I can turn it into something else.
Oh, really? Is he Tuscan?
Good question.
Now, you have a whole variety of breads. You have a variety of doughs, but you like the idea, you said you like the idea of having one that you could make different kinds of breads out of.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what bakers do always and have always done. It's not really, it's more like an operating principle. And I think to some degree, that, you know, it, baking lends itself to that type of play, that type of manipulation. It's, you know, it is changeable in its nature. I think that's why, you know, like, you know, you can't really be an absolutist with bread baking in the sense that there's no, bread is also, as a part of human activity, is, you know, 6,000 plus, maybe 8,000 years old, maybe older, because of, you know, archaeological evidence that has been discovered from early human settlements where humans were grinding grains even during the Neolithic period, you know?
Yeah.
20,000 years ago, humans were grinding grains. Yeah. So it's probable that perhaps there were some forms of bread being made, you know? But, you know, again, prehistory, no one knows, you know?
Well, you would have needed fire, wouldn't you?
What was that?
I said you would have needed fire.
Well, fire was there. Fire has been around for quite some time.
So fire they had, huh?
Yeah, fire. Well, but it's even said that baking and the cultivation of grains and even the grinding of grains preceded ceramics.
Really?
Preceded pottery, yeah. I read something about that recently. So it is interesting. You know, I just picked up a new book on the history of bread.
Oh, I bet that's interesting.
Written by some British authors.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there you go. Well, you got the right people on board. now, one thing that I thought was interesting about this book, I mean, if people just want to know about Jim and bread, this is a great book to do that, but you have other books you've produce that do that as well. What I think is intrigued me about this book is you expand your horizon and you talk about all the other things you cook in the Sullivan Street Bakery, which are not bread.
So yes, and also we just, you know, having fun. I mean, it's kind of like a thin selection of some of the things that we've made and some of the things that we currently make over the last 23 years. There are a lot of items that were never included in the book, just for editorial reasons, and we could have made the book six times the size if we had added everything that we'd ever made, and maybe given more room to everything. But the idea was really to kind of focus on kind of the spirit of the bakery and the cafe that we have,
right.
And then also embrace getting to and understanding how dough is made and how fermentation works.
And I'm in love with your pizza recipes. You're so creative in your toppings for pizza.
Oh, why, thank you.
Oh, I love them.
Yeah, but
that's what I really
started doing. The apple and the brie pie is really, really fun.
Yeah, but who knew, Jim, that Italians made chili?
Well, no, I think, well, you know, Italians make all sorts of things that aren't part of the specific, you know, like when we think of it, what we know is based only on what we've seen. But, you know, if you look into books like, do you know Sander Katz's book?
Yes.
And does it.
So, like, he has a recipe for fermented tomato paste that I've never seen here in the U.S., but it does exist as something in Italy. And it would also make sense that you could use the exact same preservation process whereby you take the meat, the tomatoes, and you remove some of the water, but then at the same time it begins to ferment and acidify, and it becomes so acidic that it actually is like spoil-proof.
Yes, you said that.
The pH is so low. So, you know, we end up making, like, fermented chilies based on my love of lacto-fermentation, which is a completely separate thing from Sullivan Street Bakery, let's say. Enough of the bakery, from Italian baking, let's say. But if you go to Italy, I mean, they're all into lacto-fermentation, too.
And that has nothing to do with milk. Let's clarify that.
Yeah, it has nothing to do. Lactofermentation just means that lactobacilli, bacteria that you would find in milk, for spoilage of milk, also affect meats and vegetables and can transform them into, you know, delectables and also aid in our digestion, making food easier to eat and metabolize and take nutrients. It also is obviously probably the number one way in which that and salt are the number one ways in which human beings have preserved food, you know, part of the key to food preservation.
Right.
The book I just bought recently is called History of Bread.
Yes.
By Bernard Dupin, P-A-I-G-N-E. And I believe it is it's more like a modern history than ancient history, although it has a little bit of ancient history. The best book I've ever read on the history of bread is a book called 6,000 Years of Bread by M.E. Jacob, which is really brilliant, because it's also, it's trying to fill in, you know, thousands of years of gaps, of lack of knowledge, lack of information, lack of text, lack of writing, because it just doesn't exist.
Well, you know, I think that this book would be worth the purchase price just to get your recipe for your orange olive oil cake.
Yes. And the bombolonia. And the bombolonia are amazing. It's a very simple brioche recipe, very reproducible. Not difficult at all.
I'm going to try those and see if I can stuff an anchovy in there.
Yeah, you should. Sfinge.
Sfinge. S-F-I-N-G-E.
Sfinge.
You got it already.
Sfinge. Sfinge.
It's S-F.
He's going to make them for his. He's going to make them for his wife.
Yeah.
I'm going to make them for my wife.
So now let's get back to the content of this book. I mean, you have a whole section on sandwiches, and I'm telling you, they just look so scrumptious. And you're interested in the filling as well as the bread, right?
Yes.
And you have some really unusual ones, like what's the one with the kimchi in it?
A chicken sandwich with kimchi. It's a roast chicken sandwich with kimchi. Or maybe we use kimchi with our chickpea, like our version of a falafel.
You like falafel too, you said.
I love falafel.
And then you have a whole section that you've never done before on slow cooking and roasting, which is valuable.
Yes, and you know, again, playfulness and in the case of the brisket, you know, it was inspired by a trip that I had made to Central Asia, where I had to cook halal, you know, for people. I couldn't use any alcohol or stuff, so I just tried to make something up. Again, it's just about being playful. But I'm not like I'm not as a chef, kind of like bound by like rules.
Uh-huh. You know, I was laughing reading your L'Amico di Polo, the roasted Japanese turnips with chicken.
Yeah.
And it reminded me that there was we had a friend who was from Italy. She was from Milano, actually. And she was having a party, and she hired a caterer. And they put out one of those crudité trays, and it included thin sliced turnips on it. And she was so upset. She said, in Italy, we feed those to pigs.
Yeah.
So, but
there are a lot of ways in which Italians eat.
Uh-huh.
That, yeah, they follow kind of some pretty strict, beliefs and folklore, but you know, from one section region to another, they can be kind of like completely, contradicted. So, for example, a friend of mine who lives in San Gimignano.
Yes.
And we're walking along, and I see some lavender, and I pick a branch of lavender off, and I start eating it. I'm like, hey, let's collect some of this for our chicken roast tonight. He goes, no, you can't do that, because lavender is toxic.
Oh, no.
But then you drive, you know, 50 miles across the valley, or 25 miles across the valley to another town, and the chef there, like, you know, uses lavender in a rub, you know?
It's funny, the first time Peter and Anne went to Provence together, in preparation for going there, we planted a lavender bush, and we used lavender in the same way in general that people from that region use rosemary. When we got there, we discovered that all the lavender went to grass to make
the same
perfume.
Thing. It's the same, an analogous plant with very similar flavor profile. I mean, you know, there are so many similarities. You know,
there are so many things I love about this
book. And you know, like, you know, sage contains a neurotoxin. You know.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I guess if you ate enough of it, you would probably suffer. But, I mean, no one's ever going to eat that much. But there it is. For thousands of years, it's, you know, it's either a medicine or it's a culinary herb or a little bit of both, you know?
Well, this book is like a very wonderful onion. You keep pulling back the skins and finding new gems.
Well, I have to give credit to my wife, who's such an incredible writer and researcher.
Well, Maya, you did great.
She's nodding her head.
Oh, good. So, and again, the price of the book is worth getting your panettone recipe.
And we have the panettone, yes.
Yeah, so... Anyhow, you got to get that for Easter, right?
Yes.
Well, Jim Lee, I'm going to have to tell you what I make from this book, okay?
Okay, I can't wait to hear it.
I love it. I really love it. And you have my interest and my, I don't know, I'm lusting after these recipes. So I'm going to actually put my mind to it and make some of these things.
Yeah, I can't wait to see you guys again. Hopefully we'll see each other this year in Chicago.
Yeah,
head down to Food and Wine if you guys head down to Food and Wine in Miami, let me know. You can come by the bakery. We opened a bakery there.
Oh, you have a bakery in Miami too?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. How is that going?
Yeah. It's going.
Where is it?
In a neighborhood called Little Haiti.
Okay, I know that neighborhood.
So, yeah, but if you're down, shoot me an email, and I'd love to have you over and see what we do.
Right. Well, if we're there, it's like the first time we went to the Food and Wine, there were like 30,000 people, and
oh,
now it's
insane.
Like 300,000 people. Right.
Well, my bakery is not on the beach.
Right.
So I'm going to be mostly there.
Great. Well,
except to go to a few parties on the beach.
Okay. Well, there are lots of those, that's for sure. Well, I love the book, and congratulations, Jim, to you and to Maya. And,
well, thank you very much,
Best Ann. Luck with this book, and I think people are going to fall in love with it is what I think.
Oh, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jim.
For the time. Thank you, Ann.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Peter. Bye, Ann.
And we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next stop is, well, if you say Zingerman's, you're saying a number of different things because it's sort of an octopus of an operation. I happen to really love the deli side of it, but
turns out it's a whole lot more than just the deli.
Oh, it certainly is. And it's an institution in Ann Arbor, which is my alma mater. And I must say that we had a really interesting discussion, specifically about Zingerman's Bakehouse Bakery. And that's the book that they wrote, which is a separate operation from all these other things we're talking about. So, listen to Amy Emberling and Frank Carolla, who are the principals at this baking operation.
I could use a Zingerman's sandwich right now, but we're going to be talking to the people responsible for the wonderful bread and a bunch of other things. Amy Emberling and Frank Carolla. The book is Zingerman's Bakehouse. And I was just tripping down the path of nostalgia with you two about having gone to school in Ann Arbor and, you know, how this was a very big thing in my life, Zingerman's.
Let's emphasize, first of all, Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Yes.
The home of the University of Michigan and the home of Zingerman's Deli.
And it's bigger than that.
Going back several decades ago as being the ultimate Reuben sandwich. Now let's fast forward from there.
Yes. The book is now specifically The Bakehouse, which was a later entry into the business, which is huge. I mean, what was your introduction was by Ari, who is a co-founder of Zingerman's, and what was his major? Harry Weinsler?
Russian history.
Russian. I knew it was something really off the wall. But he is such a visionary in terms of business that I'm not surprised that Zingerman's has grown into this. Tell me now, it's how many companies? 10?
Yes, 10.
Oh, boy. And you touch on all manner of things. And your bakehouse, Frank, you were a co-founder, and Amy, you've been there a long time, and you're sort of the soul of it right now. But you wrote this. This is your first book, and you write that it's three things, and I was fascinated with this. First of all, cookbook, and of course I want all these wonderful recipes. Secondly, which is very much this process thing of descriptions of how you work or explanations of how you work. And then thirdly, your business story. Could somebody take each of those and explain how it's developed first or that they were developed?
Well, you mean as themes in the book, Anne, or?
Yes. The book. Well, we're talking about the book.
Sure. Well, you know, at times customers have asked us to write a book, and we've thought maybe we should write a book, but we didn't, and initially, because I realized that there are many, many baking books out there, and really the world didn't need another baking book. So I thought, if we're going to write a book, it has to add or bring something that maybe other bakers can't bring. And I thought, well, what can we bring that other people haven't already done or won't do in the future? Well, so the first thing was that we would share some of our recipes that customers have loved over the years.
Oh, so, and I'm happy to get those. I'm sure everybody else is too.
Right. Well, I'm hoping that people are happy to get them. And so we have included all of the biggest sellers, the recipes for all of the biggest sellers, and then some of our personal favorites, and then some recipes that we think are particularly unique to Michigan or unique to us. And maybe they aren't the biggest sellers, and maybe people will be surprised to see them, but I think they're sort of interesting, and we wanted to share them with a broader audience. And then the second thing that we thought we could share with people that no one else could was how we do our work. Because for people who don't know Zingerman's, we're pretty well known in the food business world for having some pretty unique business practices.
Right.
How we include staff in decision making, how we practice what's called open book management, and the kind of leadership that we practice here, which is called servant leadership. And, gosh, Anne, what was the third theme?
Business story.
Oh, business stories. Well, and then for us, you know, it's so much more than just coming to work and making loaves of bread. It's a community of people. And so we wanted to share some of the stories of what had happened over the years. And so a little bit nostalgic.
Well, now, there's a fourth thing, though, and anybody launching into this book will recognize it, is, and it's so much a part of Zingerman's, is the equation, part of the equation that's the personality of you people. And you do describe how you arrived at Zingerman's. Frank does, and Amy started out in a different direction. But it's your personalities imprinted on the business and on this cookbook, right?
I think so. Yes, absolutely. And we weren't sure whether people necessarily would find that interesting, but we thought it was the story that we wanted to tell.
Well, it's a warm, friendly story, and it's also funny, I think.
What did you find funny about it?
I just think that it's just amusing, even to the caricatures drawn of you guys. I just think there's an inherent sense of fun that probably you experience in the workplace, too.
I'm thinner than those caricatures make me look, just so you know.
Are you younger, too?
Yeah,
younger.
So, I can't figure out how there's so much in this book, how to actually, one thing I thought was curious is you have such distinct personalities, you came from such different backgrounds, you have one section about how you partner. Tell us about that.
Frank, you want to start?
Well, I can start. You know, I guess when we started baking bread back in 92. Amy was here from the beginning, but she certainly wasn't a partner then, but she was more interested in what was going on than any of the other people that we had working here, and she was incredibly interested in learning and helping the business get going, and so early on she became one of the first people to help me manage the bread bakery, and then she had prior pastry training, so she for a couple of years helped lead the pastry department, and you know, during those early years we grew to enjoy really working with each other and trusting each other's ability, and you know, one thing about being someone's partner is you've got to whether it's all good when things are all successful and happy, but the reality is a startup business has a bunch of challenges, and we had the opportunity to work side by side and weather some of those difficult times, and you learn really to trust somebody. And as life happened, Amy traveled to Denmark, left the bakehouse in 96, and lived in Denmark for a year, and then came back and lived in New York City, and those were the days before the internet or cell phones, so we continued to communicate via postcards, which so many people nowadays can't even imagine. But
we were recently back in Australia, and I recalled that when we lived there, there was no internet. I mean, I don't even imagine. I can't imagine how we managed to communicate and stay attached to the rest of the world 10,000 miles away.
Right, right. But we did. We stayed connected, and Amy was gone away from the bakehouse for 4 years, and by the year 2000, the business had grown to a point where I personally couldn't support all the different aspects of it in the way I wanted to, and I realized I didn't need another manager. I had a large number of really good managers, but what I needed was someone to come in and help really lead the business into the future, help support the various parts of the bakehouse, come up with new ideas. And the great thing about Amy is that she's the innovator, and so she came back with a lot of really, really great ideas and the energy to try new things.
Okay,
and
so now I'm going to interrupt, which is more characteristic of our relationship. But I so Frank is telling you, which is totally makes sense since he's the engineer of the two of us, you know, the factual data of how this all happened. But I think a partnership can really be incredible or it can not be. And I think ours has been lucky in that we have very contrasting skills, and so we can bring different things to the bakery. Sometimes, though, having those contrasting perspectives and skills can lead to some fiery moments because we may not always understand each other or appreciate the other person's
That's
perspective.
For sure.
Right. So I think it's been really great in that there we have a deep respect for one another, but we also have some very different approaches. And that diversity of perspective and approach, I think, has helped the business. And as we've been together as partners for so many years now, a lot of the disagreements have been understood and worked out. So
and you,
overall, it's really
and you
great.
Laugh at his jokes.
I love his jokes, and I actually, the more he tells the same joke, the funnier the joke gets, because it's so ridiculous. And now I tell his jokes, so it's just impossible. Or I ask him when he's not telling the joke at the right moment to tell the joke. So, there now, you have it.
Now, there's another character involved in this whole venture, right?
Now, who's the other character?
Ari, whatever his name is.
Yes, there's Ari. There's our partners Ari and Paul, who are important
they were the
characters.
Co-founders
the co-founders of Zingerman's overall. And we engage with them when we have sort of larger, bigger picture issues to work out. And I think the four of us together have developed a nice working relationship.
But day to day, the bake house is Frank and Amy.
Exactly. Yes.
Now the one.
And you said it right, Frank and Amy, as if it's one word.
Frank and Amy. Now I was intrigued by the scholarship program, and the scholarship program in particular as it relates to Cornish pasties. But the whole idea that if someone had a good idea, you would help fund them to develop it further so that they could bring it back as a more complete thought to the business. I thought that was really intriguing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know what I think is unfortunate in so many organizations, not just food ones, is that we only hear about the people who maybe, you know, put their name on the book or sign the bank loans. But there are so many talented, motivated, interested people who are working in organizations across the country and who are doing the innovative work and are actually making the change. So here, we really try to open things up and make it possible for people to explore their interests. And one way is by giving out scholarships, and in particular, usually to study some kind of food interest of theirs. So a woman here was very interested in Cornish pasties, and we do make them in Michigan. They're a specialty of our Upper Peninsula. And so she said, well, I'd love to go to Cornwall and really learn how they do it there. And we said, fantastic. Why don't you go and then come back and let's try to make authentic Cornish pasties. Her name was also Anne, and so she's done a great job, and we make them from October through March each year. We're gearing up to make them now. Customers were already asking about them in August. When were they coming back? So it's a joyful system that we have here.
Let me tell you one thing we'll remove this from the recording if you want us to. The interesting thing about the Cornish pasty recipe is, compared to regular Cornish pasties in Cornwall, you have way too much meat in them.
Yeah, I mean.
Well, Well, maybe that's the Jewish indulgent mother side, version of the Cornish pasty.
I think it's that people in Cornwall are like people from Yorkshire, where I come from originally. they're pretty cheap.
Okay.
And meat's expensive. Potatoes and vegetables are not expensive, but meat is. Yeah.
Sure.
Now, there are the usual things that we'd expect out of this, especially with the recipes, but not many cookbooks mention their failures, both little and the biggest. I thought that was very amusing. Tell us about that.
Sure.
I still don't understand what was wrong with it, those cookies. What was wrong with them? The Christmas box or whatever it was.
The hamutaska were delicious.
It wasn't I think we're talking about the Christmas cookies.
Oh, the Christmas cookies.
Yeah.
There was nothing wrong with that. That was one of the most exciting and best ideas we've ever had here. It's just that the bookstores didn't put any energy into selling them, and we had, whatever it was, thousands of boxes in every Borders store in the United States at the time. And after, I forget what it was, after a month or something, they had only sold a couple of boxes. And so it was a crazy, crazy thing. And we had thousands and thousands of boxes ready to do the reorder that we laughed about every time we walked in the warehouse and saw pallets of these boxes taking up space for years. So we repurposed them, stuck a label over them, turned them into something else, and
moved on.
Yeah, found a way to laugh about it. It's funny to be able to laugh later. In the moment, there's nothing particularly humorous about when you're in the middle of it, the big disaster or failure.
Yeah, well, you have that in the category of unexpected and surprising successes and major flops. You have another section that I thought was interesting. Where was that now? The one right before the next vision. I want to talk about next vision, too. What was the one before that? Well, let's talk about the next vision, because this visioning, I think you use it as a verb, is something that the people at Zingerman's have always talked about. And I'm not sure I understand that, but tell us about it.
Sure, I'd love to tell you about it. So visioning is a process of projecting into the future what you want to have happen. And it's not a strategic plan. It's actually describing a time in the future as you wish it to be, sort of your preferred future. And so it's different from a strategic plan in that you don't edit. You don't decide, oh, that's not possible, I can't put that in there. You really put out there what you hope to achieve. And then you describe it and you write it in a very kind of vivid way so that you can see it, and that's why it's called visioning. And it's not very different than if you hear, you know, sort of Olympic athletes, how they, before a race, have in their mind, you know, write a vision of their successful run of the race or their successful high jump. So it's the same sort of thing, but using it in a different context. So you can use it in your personal life, for your family, or your relationship, or your personal career. And we do that here, and we also then do it for where do we want our businesses to be in the future. So at the moment, the vision for the Bakehouse for the future isn't set. We're actually going to engage the crew here after Christmas and sort of have some open meetings and dialogues and discussions and have people write drafts of their own and share ideas and see what we can come up with and where we really want to be, say, in 10 years from now. I know that there are a few things that many of us are thinking about. We're probably going to get into milling some of our own grain.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah, and trying to, you know, the freshness of flour is something that we don't talk that much about in the general community. Bakers are talking about it more, and so, you know, the grain can be held for a long time, but it's better to grind it closer and closer to the time of its use. It has more nutrients in it. So we're probably going to mill some of our flour, and we're really working on developing local sources for more of our grains. It, you know, wasn't the sort of the growing wheat in Michigan is no longer done very much, but it is possible, and we've started to work with the farmers here.
A question. How did you get involved with the Hungarian flavors?
Yeah, so the Hungarian flavors work came out of our last vision. We wanted to find a part of the world to learn the baking tradition. And we just started looking around, where might we want to go, and thinking about places that sounded appealing to us. Or we also had to think of, you know, how much it would cost to get there if we wanted to go many times and that sort of thing. And so through that journey, I just sort of happened upon some Hungarian cookbooks, and I was really surprised at the breadth and the depth of the Hungarian cuisine. And, you know, it's a very old and developed cuisine. And so then we went there, Frank and me and Ari, and I don't know if you know the cookbook author, Molly Stevens. She's a dear friend
Molly.
Of Zingerman's.
Yeah.
Right, and Molly came with us, and we spent about a week in Budapest and the surroundings, and we really fell in love with it. And it was really perfect for the bakery because they have wonderful pastries, and they have breads, and they have soup is a very big part of their meal, and we happen to make soup here. Then the final reason that it was just so compelling to us is that the largest thriving Jewish community in Eastern Europe today is in Budapest. And the beginnings of Zingerman's were as a Jewish delicatessen.
Right.
So it had some consistency and some connection for us. And I thought, what could be better than going to Budapest and seeing matzo ball soup there or stuffed cabbage?
Uh-huh.
So that's how we got involved in it. It's been a very joyful exploration.
Now, I mean, I think it would be remiss if we didn't list some of these your most popular favorite recipes that people are going to look for when they pick up this book. Zingerman has the number of stars on its menus that people seek out. Can you run through a few of them?
Well, probably the one that, the sour cream coffee cake is certainly
right.
one big star that people have been really wanting the recipe for most of the 25 years that we've been in existence. And for some odd reason, we've had our baking school for 11 years now, where we've been teaching home bakers all of these recipes, but that was one that we hadn't taught before. And then all of our most popular breads, the farm bread and sourdough, and then the new favorites, the dinkelbrot and chestnut baguette, and our graham crackers.
Oh, I love
the brownies, Frank.
Yeah.
Oh, the brownies.
The brownies are in there, and the Boston cream pie.
And my all-time favorite, the pecan pie.
Oh, yes. The pecan pie is really luxurious, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
It is.
Well, I mean, everybody buying this book will get his or her money's worth, because it's just filled with information, and it's just so much fun as well. It seems like we'd all like to come and work with you guys.
Well, you know, we're hiring, so if you want to come, come on up.
We'd love to take you up on that offer.
they need someone to help them make Cornish pasties.
Yeah, that's for sure.
We do.
Well, congratulations, Amy and Frank, on a business well-wrought, a quality product, and this the very latest achievement is this wonderful book.
And don't forget to pass along to Anne the Masterpiece Theatre production of the third series of Poldark set in Cornwall.
Yeah.
He started last night.
Okay,
I'll make sure she knows about that.
It'll make her very nostalgic, I'm sure.
Yeah, we were just in Cornwall in July, weren't we? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, Peter's brother lives there. So, we don't usually get pasties, so.
They do get pasties.
Okay.
Our son insisted. Our son has a love affair with pasties.
He does, yes.
Oh, interesting.
So he got some. We probably
always get pork pies, don't we?
Well, listen, let's let these people go and start
right.
start making Cornish pasties and all these other all these other wonderful things. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been so much fun talking to you.
Thank you. Thanks for all the support.
Thank you.
Yes, our pleasure. It was great speaking to you as well. Thanks.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Finish out today's program. Eco-vessel doesn't necessarily sound like it. Perhaps it's anything to do with cooking and food, but it turns out that it is.
It does?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's ecological, I guess. And they're vessels of various different kinds.
This is a stretch, Rabbit. Sorry, it's a stretch.
But they're artfully designed objets.
Yes, they're containers, vessels.
Yeah,
besides that, the CEO, John Fox, is a really cool guy. Right. So he's a cool dude, yeah.
Okay, so EcoVessel's coming right up.
John Fox, it's your EcoVessels, the products are just amazing. I asked you, how do you get to do this? What did you do before this? Tell our listeners about your background and how you ended up making these wonderful eco-friendly vessels.
Sure. Well, basically I was in the healthcare field in alternative health and founded and was running a massage acupuncture chiropractic clinic. From there I started getting interested in different ways to help people, including different products called light therapy and lasers, and started learning about manufacturing through certain amounts of water filtration machines, which not only were able to filter water but provide pH-balanced water to balance out impurities in people's diets. And around 6-7 years ago, there was a lot of media coverage of chemicals and BPA and things like that in plastics and bottles. So I was really looking for alternatives for my family and set out to create, and there wasn't much out there that was nice looking, insulated, and reasonably priced. So I just set out to create, you know, a couple products in that area, both stylish, high performance. We've offered lifetime warranties from the beginning, so really having a customer focus. And from there, it kind of sprouted into being able to really have a product for everybody from kids up through adults. So, and we've got different options for keeping water hot and cold and coffee and wine and pretty much any beverage you can think of.
Now, how old is your company?
We are about 6 years old.
Okay.
And where are you, John? Physically, where are you in these United States?
We're located in Boulder, Colorado.
Okay.
Tends to be a little bit more progressive with picking up on new ideas like recyclability, reusability. So when it came to using reusable bottles versus single-use plastic water bottles or single-use plastics, you know, it was a really good area to, you know, start a company like this.
Right. I think I read somewhere recently that Boulder has the reputation for being the people where people are the happiest.
Yes, that was a story that actually...
You read that too, huh?
I mean, people are really kind of fit here, you know, work on education, and, you know, it's a nice community. And, you know, for things like what we do, people are definitely more interested in their health, natural foods, healthy lifestyle, exercise. So a product like ours, where we're really promoting hydration and reusability, fits really well in the community.
Yeah, I remember being in Denver once though, and my car rental was a Chrysler something or other. And every time I tried to enter one of the freeways, it was a risky proposition because the car wasn't tuned for the mountains.
Yeah, definitely a lot of
so I wouldn't go
four-wheel drive around here.
Yeah, well, we had a lot of relatives live in Boulder, and of course. You have the school, you have all kinds of
forward-thinking concepts in terms of lifestyle. So it's an ideal place. But what is your reach, the company's reach in terms of products?
So I don't know if you're referring to, like, where we sell, but we do sell globally.
Okay.
In about 20 different countries, and, you know, as well as in the U.S., you know, due to the fact that we're, you know, creating products that keep beverages hot and cold, there's really a market in lots of different channels, so we're able to be successful in, you know, more outdoor channel. We sell a lot into grocery, natural foods, and wind up doing quite a lot of customization of the products because they make great gifts. Sometimes we'll sell to breweries, and they want to promote their brand along with our brand.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, really it's the kind of product that, you know, can be successful anywhere, you know, especially because we've got really created options to create kind of an EcoVessel family. So we've created products for, you know, little kids, and, you know, the parents like the products. So it has a pretty wide reach.
Yeah, let's give our listeners an idea of the range of what you do in a kind of an unusual way.
I'm really taken with that.
One of the really neat little
bottle
products
I have, the one that has the little, what do you call it, where you put the tea in.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that.
Well, yeah, a lot of versatility.
Well, I wasn't entitled to a turn.
Okay.
The one I liked and the contrast I was making was between the little cup that the kids can take to school, because it folds down and then it folds up again.
Yeah, sure.
And curious enough, we have a couple of similar vessels that we've had for a long time, which are used just for water measurement. So it's like a cup and half a cup.
Oh yeah,
they're collapsible, and very convenient because they're much flatter when you put them in the drawer. They don't jam the drawer.
Yeah, exactly. So it's really easy to, when you're finished with it, to stow away.
But then the other end of the scale, you have growlers for beer, which I'm assuming probably keep the beer cold, but they are also magnificent in that they hold 64 ounces of beer, which is more than you and your friend can drink at one sitting, I think.
Quite a lot, yeah. So 4 pints. But the idea is you can go into a brewery and, you know, fill it up with fresh beer.
Sure.
You know, maintain the carbonation, maintain the beverage. And, you know, speaking of the tea strainer, what's really unique about that product is we've integrated a full strainer in there. So you can actually create a big basket of tea. You can do cold brew. You can even do a fruit infusion into it. And that's, you know, a feature that is in a good amount of our products and kind of our unique, you know, really differentiator between most of the other bottles that you'll find out there, is that we include that so that you really have different options for flavoring, you know, your water or your beer, et cetera.
You know, I keep going back to the ingenious design. This one container you make, it has a little built-in spoon and fork, beautifully placed in there, and it expands the vessel itself expands like the cups we were talking about by pushing it out, and then it collapses again. That doesn't keep things hot and cold, though, does it?
That one's not as designed, you know, for hot and cold as much as convenience. So, you know, more for your salads, and you know, the nice thing about it though is it's microwavable, it's freezeable, it's dishwasher safe. So, you know, you can take that on the go and heat it up, or, you know, keep it in the fridge if you're having salads and things like that.
Yeah, when we traveled when I was a child in England, when the family traveled, it was important. I never really was sure why it was important to carry hot water to be able to make tea. And the product we all used was called the thermos flask.
Exactly, yeah.
This
is an updated thermos flask. The problem with the old thermos flask is if you dropped them, that was it.
Yeah, they were glass.
Yeah, the glass inside. Yeah.
Now your the material you use is different.
Yeah, we use stainless steel. So, and what's kind of unique about ours versus the other ones that are out there right now is there's a technology built in called Trimax.
Yeah.
And, you know, instead of, you know, putting glass in the inner layer, it's basically two layers of stainless steel. And what we do is we copper coat the inner layer, and then we vacuum insulate it. And
it's
a vacuum that basically keeps helps it to maintain the temperature. And the copper is, you know, the unique aspect of it, which helps you to maintain the same temperature throughout the whole product. So, you know, in the way you're used to, like, heat rising, the liquids in your beverage stay the same temperature, whether it's at the bottom, the middle, or the top. And that's due to the properties of copper.
That's amazing. So you do a lot of R&D, don't you?
Definitely. We design everything here in Boulder, Colorado. We print our prototypes. We have a designer in-house and, you know, do quite a lot of testing of the products.
Now, do you actually make them in Colorado or are they made somewhere else?
Yeah, we make them overseas, you know, since they're stainless steel and bottles and vacuum insulated, the machinery's, you know, actually not even really available in the U.S.
Oh, really? Why is that?
So you just had an idea and then you found someone who could create your idea.
Yeah, essentially, you know, there just isn't that kind of machinery and manufacturing currently, you know, here for our types of products. I mean, the U.S. makes great products, but, you know, not, you know, we're not really set up to make everything, especially, you know, things that are maybe a little smaller and, you know, not as technologically advanced as maybe circuit boards or things like that.
I see. So it's more basic production.
Somewhat. You know, it's I mean, just the machinery that is used for vacuum insulating it and, you know, cutting the steel and the tubes and things like that is just not something, you know, currently available in the U.S.
Okay, but you found a place to make it. Now I was intrigued by a couple of things in particular. And one is the wine bottle. Now, how does that work? Do you actually put the bottle with the glass and everything in the container? Or do
I mean,
you
essentially, the point, if you want to take your wine on the go currently, you know, glass wine bottles are typically really heavy.
Yes,
they are. And they're made from glass. If you drop them, they're going to break. And, of course, they don't have any insulation properties. So what we did is we, you know, took sort of that classic wine bottle shape, and we made it out of stainless steel, used that same Trimax vacuum-insulated technology that you know, that I just talked about. And you can pour an entire wine bottle in there, 750 milliliters, and it's going to maintain that temperature for up to 36 hours. Basically,
wow.
Whatever's going on outside doesn't affect what's inside. And what we've done is we've paired it up with a funnel to make it easy to pour in and a brush to, you know, make sure you can easily clean the bottle.
Okay, there you go.
Oh, wow.
So you're actually emptying the wine bottle.
And it looks cool.
Into your new container.
Yeah, I looked at the picture of it. It really did look cool.
And for wine lovers, it's a great gift, and it's a, you know, it's patent-pending design that we created.
Here's the funny thing. We actually have in our possession two Victorian-era wine coolers.
I was thinking the same thing.
And they're large enough that the bottle goes inside.
Yeah.
And then did you put ice around it? I can't remember.
The brass is shaped like a bottle of wine, but bigger, of course, leaving space. So you have an insert that you put the ice in, then you put the insert in, and the insert actually is like looks like aluminum or something, but tin or whatever it does, Victorian. And then you put the bottle in there, and so it's the ice around it within this container. And it's very good looking too.
Yeah, we could send you a picture of it. It looks very
I mean, I love everything that carries beverages, so definitely be interested in seeing that.
Yeah, well, we spend a lot of time carrying beverages around. We have a dining club where everybody brings wine into, even into, you know, restaurants. We cause a lot of trouble that way.
But same thing, like if you want to go to a restaurant, you want to, you know, you bring your bottle of wine, you can just pour it in there. It'll keep the same temperature when you get to the restaurant. If you've got a red wine, you know, typically you want to maintain that,
right,
you know, that room temperature. So if you're out in 90 degrees, that red's going to heat up pretty quickly. So, you know, the wine bottle doesn't only just keep to work to keep white's cold, but it maintains the temperature of anything that's in there, like a red.
Now let's talk about some of the other products before we forget.
Okay.
So we've talked about growlers, we've talked about wine coolers, we've talked about keeping things hot and cold.
and thermos that
keeping things tidy, which is the packed lunch
packed
thing,
lunch
I guess.
Things.
What else is out there in the eco vessel family?
Well, you know, kind of starting at the youngest ages, we make reusable bottles for kids, and you know, it's kind of part of the way that we got started. Is, you know, my kids were started going to school, you know, around that 6-7 years ago, and now kids are really expected to bring their own bottle, and they're really taught about, you know, reusability at a young age. So we've kind of created some really unique products for kids, unique designs, and we've actually partnered with in a company called LK that puts water bottle fill stations in airports and gyms and schools all across the country.
Uh-huh.
So we're partnering with them to do fundraisers for schools across the country to install these fill stations, and they are able to market and sell EcoVessel products, and, you know, we offer it to the schools at a discount, and they sell it kind of like Girl Scout cookie method.
That's
and
good.
They're able to raise enough funds, learn about reusability, and they can put these fill stations into their schools so that they're using reusable bottles. So starting with the kids, we have kind of a full line for kids. And the adult stuff, I guess, our core line is similar to the Growler, has a similar top, and it's called the Boulder line, and has that same feature that you had mentioned earlier, which is that strainer for tea and fruit. Has multiple lid openings, and it includes that same Trimax triple insulation to keep things hot for 8 hours and cold for up to 36 hours. So really designed to be kind of a one-stop shop for, you know, anything having to do with beverages, whether it's water, coffee, tea, wine, etc.
Now tell me that your website is very informative. What is the web address?
It's ecovessel.com. Pretty much just how it sounds, ecovessel.com.
And distribution-wise, I noticed that you can buy them through Amazon. Do you also distribute directly yourselves?
Definitely, yeah. So, you know, we love to have a direct relationship with our customers through our website, and, you know, can offer them when we come out with new products. Like if you go on our website now, the Gold is a new version of the wine bottle that just came out, and we tend to, you know, we like to offer them to our customers and our social media fans, you know, really early. Usually we'll hit Amazon and other retailers.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by the speed at which you turn out all these new products. I mean, I just want to know how you do. You say you're a designer. Well, how many? Just one designer to do this?
Yeah, I mean, it's really a team effort, but, you know, we have a designer in-house, and, you know, we have a creative director, and, you know, we all kind of collaborate on different ideas and different designs and, you know, meet to go over styles, colors, new products, you know.
John, I want to come and be on that committee. I think I'd have more fun.
we it sounds like you'd have some great ideas for us.
Yes, I'd love it.
She'd have that, too.
It would be fun. Yeah, we went to a brainstorming session for Anchor, what is it, the glass people?
Oh, Anchor Hocking.
Anchor Hocking. Yeah, and their designer had a brainstorming session with a bunch of us. And I came up with an idea that they never advanced, but somebody else picked it up and made it in a different material. Instead of glass, they made it in plastic, which is not nearly as attractive, but it was following the trend of everybody buying fresh herbs instead of dry herbs, and how
right.
do you keep them in the refrigerator?
Sure.
Why don't you make one of these? This is a really good idea.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
I'm going to schedule a meeting for next week and have you out to go over it. You'll definitely be part of the test.
Oh, John, that's fun. Well, you've been a delight to talk to. And, at any time you want me to come out there and brainstorm, I'm happy.
I'd love to, get some feedback on different product ideas and send some other stuff out to you guys and, see what other ideas we can move forward.
And, well, John, we hope that you have a very successful holiday season, and you sell lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of eco vessels.
Appreciate it. We would like that too.
Thank you so much for joining us on the menu today.
Great. Thanks a lot for your time.
Bye-bye, John.
So there you have it. Two breads and a vessel. you never know what those guys from On Menu Radio are going to come up with next.
It's called laid back.
Well, one of the things we sure know is that this time next week, same time, same place, we'll be here. We hope you will be too. And until then,
bye bye.